end of the day, probably. What's the charm of it? The charm of it is you're getting a really interesting slice of someone's creative thought and thinking, and it comes out. Anyway, I'm way off the deep end here, but we can circle back a little bit to say that playing it like you sing it, that is the secret sauce. That is what we're trying to do.
I've got two great quotes from two great pipers to read to you, and they've got something in common. First one comes from Jack Lee. He says, "Sitting and studying a piece of music helps, but it's not enough for me." That's Jack Lee speaking. He says, "It needs to be an active process. While looking at the music, I will tap my foot, sing the tune, nod my head, hold the piece of paper in both hands, finger along with what I'm singing, dot, dot, dot. I find that the more I engage myself, i.e. the more parts of me that are engaged, eyes, ears, foot, fingers, voice, etc., the more rapid the journey toward memorizing, I might say, or internalizing, the tune or music becomes." And I got another quote from Stuart Little. Much shorter, I promise. Stuart Little says, "I find that singing the phrase of a tune, either internally or externally, is very helpful in the process of memorizing."
Yes.
The thing that I'm looking at here is the singing. I don't know about you, Andrew, but I feel like I've often chuckled to myself how as I get to know more and more pipers and drummers as well, I feel like maybe it's not representative, but I feel like there's kind of like a lot of us here who are kind of quiet in public, like not public speakers, that kind of stuff. And it strikes me as funny because the instruments we play are so loud. But it does make me wonder does that mean that there's maybe like a strong representation of pipers and drummers who maybe aren't super comfortable singing? Maybe that's me totally guessing, right? But these quotes like this and things like Barry Shear's book, Play It Like You Sing It, they make me feel like, should I be singing? Like, maybe that's a really useful tool. I don't have to sing in public. I could just sing all by myself. But what do you think? Have you ever come across this, or do you sing yourself when you're learning something?
For sure. So I sing exclusively, no doubt about it, absolutely all the time, which is really kind of interesting, right? When you teach, right, it's a huge danger. It's a huge danger. And I think I'm certainly have been guilty of that. You completely skip the most important part of all. Right? You're completely skipping it, right? Keep those grace notes as short as absolutely possible, right? So they're nice
and crisp.
That's
where you go to focus, yeah.
Right? And so the student works on keeping those grace notes really crisp. But like, why am I saying that, right? And that's because when I sing the tune, the grace note actually has no duration when I sing the tune. In my mind, I'm not hi-um, ba-hi-ya, hi-ya, un-hi-ya. That's not how I'm singing it. Right. And as a matter of fact, if I did sing it that way, it would sound really silly. And so like, I'm not singing it that way. And that sort of points to the fact that if our grace notes are eating up a lot of space in the tune, that would obviously be not right. But that's how we know it's not right. It's because when we compare it to our mental model of the tune, we need the two things to sound the same. Mm. Right? That's better than... Right? What advice would you give to a player that sounded like that?
Tighten up those grace notes.
Well, and then, but why? Not just because, but because that's what's required to
let the melody
to get it to
through.
Match. Yeah, to get it to match what you're thinking. So, play it like you sing it. It's funny, Jim, because I had a student here in the office just the other day, and I don't know if you can see my three rules of solo competing, but what's the top one?
Oh man, it's not quite, I'm sorry.
I'll read it for you.
I bet the video feed will come through better. Yeah, right now it's kind of pixely for me.
I'll read it for you. What you'll find it says is, play it like you'd sing it.
Oh.
With sing it underlined. That's my number one rule.
And,
by the way,
okay, that's fascinating.
I screwed up my. I'm shorter than you now. Now that I screwed up my camera here,
I can reframe it. But that's just for the listening audience. Just so you know, Andrew did not get up and go over there and plant that on the chalkboard after he realized that we were going to talk about this. That was genuinely there already.
Yes, exactly. It's sort of the golden rule. And by the way, just practically speaking, it's something I come back to often. What we need to do when we're in these high pressure performance situations where things tend to go crazy and you're feeling nervous and I feel like distractions are hard to ignore and stuff like that, like at the Worlds or in a big solo competition or in the PBROC especially, right? You can kind of, it's so slow and so hypnotic sort of that it's easy to kind of lose track of where you are. And so for me, if I go back to just singing the tune, that helps me immensely, I find.
Yeah.
I just stay focused on singing it. And all I have to do is sing it from the beginning to the end, and I'm good. And by the way, if I feel myself about to get lost in my singing, then that's how I know I should cut my chanter out here, because I'm a little bit lost. It's not quite going right. Anyway, so from a practical standpoint, I'm always singing as I'm playing, right? I always have that. I always have that model. But then I'd like to go a little bit deeper here and say that's the name of the game, right? The name of the game with any of this stuff is we are extracting an image of something in our mind, and then we are enacting it in the physical world. And then we are measuring the results. This is how it all works. By the way, science works in the same way. You conjecture an idea, right? And then in the real world, you find a test for that idea that you're not actually trying to test that your conjecture is true. You're actually trying to prove it wrong via experimentation.
Oh, sure. Are there holes in this idea?
Right. You're trying to falsify it, right? Because you can never prove an idea is true, but you can prove that it's false. But anyway, it's a fascinating scientific feedback loop. But then what we're doing as musicians, it's the same, right? So we are conjecturing an idea, right? I think if I do this, what it'll sound like in the physical world will be really amazing. And then you try it. And then if it's amazing, you don't for sure know it's a good technique yet. But if it comes out and it's total nonsense, then you know to try something else. Mm-hmm. So we have this sort of scientific feedback loop in what we're playing as well. But it all starts from the inside of your mind. I think that's
fun.
But it's true. Yeah. And that's why, and that's why even from a sort of nitty gritty scientific philosophical angle, what we're doing is we're playing it like we'd sing it, because it all begins in the mind. As a matter of fact, I kind of think all art probably boils down to that same thing. So you formulate an idea in your mind, and then you measure the results of that idea based on what you're able to manifest into the real world. And that's the fun of it, right? So when we play the bagpipes, we have an idea in our mind. And by the way, the idea might be very vaguely formulated. For example, if you're a beginner and you're trying to get a low G, the idea you have in your head, you're not singing low G yet. You probably don't really even know what that means. But what's the idea that we have? Low G means all my fingers are covering the holes. And then we should get a nice pure low note out of it. That's basically all you would know at that point. But over time, you start to realize this is what I'm going for. You start to formulate that idea in your mind. And then now your job is to get that to come out on the pipes. It's fun and it's interesting and challenging. And it's infinitely soul crushing too, in the sense that you'll never be able to perfectly manifest the thing in your mind.
I think that's probably been the cause of at least a few artists going mad.
For sure. Now, going back to what Jack Lee was saying in that quote, right? He's talking about creating the idea in his mind.
Yeah.
That's what he's really talking about. He's not really talking about playing it yet. He's talking about how do I get clear in my mind about how I might sing this tune. So he's talking about getting his body. He's looking at a piece of music, if I'm recalling correctly, and he's sort of tapping his fingers. He's getting his body into it. He's moving his feet, and then he's singing the notes that he sees on the page. And he's sort of using all that he can to get clear on exactly how that tune might be sung. And then he's going to try to make a copy of that on his own bagpipe. And of course, the copy will not be, it's not actually a copy. It's a copy with his own personal ideas and his own personal voice kind of attached to that. Right. And that's what makes it really kind of interesting.
Jack.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. It's a combination of pre-existing ideas and then Jack's own unique expressive ideas. And then what's cool about that is now let's say me, I hear a recording or I'm there while Jack is doing that.
Yeah.
And then now I get, it's strikingly, fascinatingly similar to the idea of natural selection, right? So Jack Lee has made a copy of that tune with his changes added in.
Mm.
Now I'm going to hear that tune and I've got two options. I love that. That's amazing. So Jack is now passing on the tune with his changes to me, let's say. And what am I going to do with that tune? I have no choice. I'm going to try to replicate what Jack did. And then either consciously or unconsciously or both, I'm going to add in my own expressive ideas to that. And then we're going to see if my version of that's going to survive in the wild. Maybe I'll pass that down and people will pick up on those sort of ideas or not. But it's sort of like survival of the fittest of creative ideas, isn't it? I don't know. It's not actually specifically that, but I digress.
Mm.
But it's like the best ideas will continue to be copied. And the ideas that weren't that great won't be copied. And by the way, if, and just throwing it out there, let's say Jack Lee is working on that tune. He plays it in a way that he doesn't like. He's not going to copy that same thing. He's not going to try to do that again. He's going to go back a step and try it in a different way. And he's going to wait until he's found what he likes before he incorporates it permanently into how he's going to present the tune.
Yeah.
But it all comes from somewhere inside of our mind.
I had an experience with this just last week where I was learning the Kesh jig on flute, which, I mean, who does the Kesh jig is a familiar tune, but what I'm learning is the flute. And so trying to figure out how to play that on the flute. And I have a friend who plays flute, who's a piper and other things as well. And I asked him, hey, what do you do with the Kesh jig? With exactly this idea in mind, where it's a really familiar tune. So it's lived this long, so we know there are good ideas there.
Exactly.
But of course, it's so present that you know every person is going to have some of their own little twists and turns they do with it.
Yeah.
And what was really fun, the like 10 minutes of video that he sent me, just kind of going through it piece by piece, it wasn't just, here are some things I like to do. It was like, I like to do this because I learned it from so-and-so who plays it this way. And then, oh, and here's a thing that I like to do. So-and-so does it in another place, but I liked it. It was a great experience of exactly this, of seeing these filters coming together and getting filtered yet again. I don't know, is it like Hegelian, right? To have the thesis, antithesis, synthesis process over and over again
Maybe.
With art?
Maybe.
It does make me think too of, there's a Bruce Springsteen song where he says, I got this guitar and I'm learning how to make it talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Sure.
And it strikes me that
what he's referring to there is what I was referring to earlier, right? When we produce art, and in our case, we're talking about making music, right? What we're trying to do is we're trying to get our instrument to produce or reproduce something that we're thinking in our mind.
Yeah. And we're talking about singing and how singing, so you mentioned that singing and playing pipes, it all comes from that same spot in the mind, right?
I also think that's why at the end of the day, indeterminate music was a flop. Are you familiar with indeterminate music?
Is it the diagram stuff where like you'll have a diagram that says then do this, then do this, then do this, but you can get to it in different ways?
The basic idea of indeterminate music is that you invent a process. And then musicians or a computer then enacts that process. You know, so a great example of that was John Cage 433, where the piano player, he just has instructions, which is you go to the piano and don't play anything. And by the way, I don't think the original score specified how long the piano player would not play anything. I think it just turned out to be 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Anyway, but that's a famous piece of music where the person didn't play nothing. And then the music ends up being all the sounds you hear in the absence of the piano player playing anything, which is very clever.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. It's super cool. But at the end of the day, you'll never turn that on and listen to it. And there's other ones too. John Cage also had radio music or something like that, where people would actually just play with radios. But then, of course, you don't know what's going to be on the radio. So then what's on the radio, it's not currently known. But, you know, it's kind of a flop. Then you have quasi-indeterminate music, some of which was highly successful, but the more directions you give the performer about specifically what they should play, the more successful the music was. And then this is just me. This is just one man's opinion. But like you look at In C by Terry Riley, right? He's giving you specific figures to play, but then he's just letting you decide what, how many times you're going to play each figure. But people
that's,
can
go, that's more what I had in mind. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But that's not fully indeterminate, right? Mm. And then my favorite one, it's the one that the Tangerine Dream ripped off by Steve Reich called Music for 16 Musicians. Tangerine Dream ripped him off in the movie Risky Business, and they got sued hard by Steve
Reich. I didn't
Reich.
Know that. I've it's seen fascinating. The movie, but didn't know that.
Yeah, it's fascinating just how hard they ripped him off. Because if you listen to Music for 16 Musicians and then listen to the soundtrack for Risky Business, it's like, whoa, bro, you're not supposed to do that. It's like exactly
it's like the
same
thing. Huh?
But it turned out to make an amazing soundtrack. And by the way, soundtracks all use, we're talking about like sort of meme replication, right? Soundtracks all use that Steve Reich vibe. So many movies use it. But then Music for 16 Musicians is pretty carefully scored piece. With just a few indeterminate elements, if I'm recalling correctly, and by the way, somebody like Matt Welch could really probably come in here and correct me hard on some of this.
His face has been in my mind the entire time we've been talking about this. Yeah.
but my point would be indeterminate music. It's an interesting idea, but by the way, this has been very long-winded. But at the end of the day, if it doesn't come from someone's mind. And you're not witnessing someone attempting to take an inexplicit idea inside your mind and manifest it out into the real world as with as much clarity as possible. That's what we're really looking for. That's what we're craving to see. It's a bag. When you play bagpipes, you're basically putting an idea out into the world that words would not be able to put out in the world. Right. That's sort of what it is. So Jack Lee can tell me how he plays a tune. And that's cool. I like that. But what I really like is when Jack plays the tune and then you're getting a little slice of him trying to bring that really unique kind of personal idea out there. Mm-hmm. And the same goes with anybody. That's what it's all about. And yeah, process-based music and indeterminate music, that's not quite that. I mean, I suppose the brain is thinking up a cool process that might come out sounding cool, but that's not really the charm of it at the end of the day, probably. What's the charm of it? The charm of it is you're getting a really interesting slice of someone's creative thought and thinking, and it comes out. Anyway, I'm way off the deep end here, but we can circle back a little bit to say that playing it like you sing it, that is the secret sauce. That is what we're trying to do.
When you describe that we're getting this little slice of this person's creativity, their attempt to express, I love the picture that you kind of painted for me that it's not just this person, right? I'm getting a slice of Jack Lee and I'm getting a slice of whoever he heard the tune from.
Yes.
And I'm getting a slice from whoever composed it. It's like,
exactly. It's a fascinating heredity, right?
Yeah.
It's heredity, but it's with ideas, not genes.
Mm.
Yes, exactly.
Now, I wonder, do you have any feelings about how to go about singing? Because it might be a personal preference thing, but like, is it humming? Is it diddling, like making up little sounds like hum da dum da 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 da? Is it, do I have to learn cantrock? If the tune already has lyrics, should I learn the lyrics or should I make up lyrics for these tunes?
You know? Fascinatingly, right? If you hum the tune, so it's a great point. And a lot of my students are like, I don't sing. And I totally,
right.
I get it, man. That really computes with me. I sing, but only privately. Mm. If someone wanted me to sing, I would get super not comfortable with it. But if you think about it, actually singing with your vocal cords is no different than playing the pipes. It's the same. You have an idea in your mind, and by using your vocal cords, you're putting it out into the physical world to see what happens. Singing with your vocal cords can be an extremely useful tool, but the singing that we're really talking about is the internal singing, the picture. And it's not a picture because it's not necessarily visual. But it's the model that your mind makes of the tune. That's what we're really talking about here. And then how do you develop that? There's only one way to develop it. You have to get it out into the world somehow. So you can sing with your vocal cords. You could whistle. You could hum. You could just try it a bunch of times on the practice chanter. You could play it on the flute. But yeah, it feels like in order to test your hypotheses, you have to do something to quickly do that loop. Yeah. So you have to something, but it's not necessarily singing with your vocal cords.
I can't help getting etymologically excited about the fact that the thing that we use to make the melody happen on bagpipes is called a chanter.
Mm-hmm.
With like, where does that word come from and what does it mean? Right. You know,
chante,
it's the singer. It's the singing part.
was it last episode we were talking about my patheticism in regards to French, but doesn't chant, doesn't that mean sing in French? I don't know.
I don't know, but I would believe you. I know that in Spanish it's cantar, right? And mm-hmm. you even have, I suspect there's a connection in cant rock as well, but I could be wrong. Sometimes there are just co-evolving things that sound similar, right?
Yes,
but I know
exactly.
For sure that Latin word chanter, this is why we have Gregorian chant, right?
Mm-hmm.
That word just means the singer. It's the singing part, right? We
yes.
could say in modern parlance. And we're talking about singing, and then we're saying to do it on the practice singer, right? Put your bagpipe under your arm, play it on the singer, right? It is the same thing. And mm-hmm. I'm struck, too, by how clever Judy Barker was. She's an amazing small pipe player who sings and plays and at the same time, right? She's just amazing. She put out an album years ago that's so good called Chanter's Weave.
Yeah.
And the chanters in question are the one on her small pipes and the one in her throat, you know? Those are the mm-hmm. two chanters that are weaving together.
Like it. It's cool.
What a brilliant lady.
But anyway, I guess what I'm sort of conjecturing here is that we have some sort of thing in our mind, right? And then we have to test that in the real world somehow. And the quicker and more fluidly and more productively we can test these ideas, the sooner they become refined. Because what we're doing, every time I play, I mean, Scotland Brave is too boring of an example. But let's take a competition 2-4 march. Every time I play that 2-4 march, it's an attempt to improve on the previous time I tried to play it. And then I could also sing it. So in between today's practice session and tomorrow's practice session, I could sing that with my voice 17 or 18 times. So I can start to sort through possible ways of thinking or playing that tune that might be more or less successful, so that when I do get it up on the pipes, I've already thrown out a lot of the bad options and I've gotten familiar with what seem to be the best options when I just sort of hum it. You'll hear a lot of pipers do that because it's a lot easier to practice with your vocal cords than up on the full pipes. I think it's a lot more efficient and you can sort of test ideas basically with your voice before you take the time and energy to put stuff up on the full pipe. So yeah, you're kind of working through it, right? You're working through different options and you're practicing getting the idea from your mind out into the real world. And then, yeah, it's all just tools.
Mm.
Like, oh, hypothesis, right? Hypothesis. Maybe if I sing it this way, maybe if I sing it with a super emphasized E, it will sound better. So then you sing it and then you're like, oh, actually that was kind of crappy. So let's not do that again. So let's try faster tempo. Oh, what happens if I sing it slower? Oh, what happens if I emphasize the C more? And blah, blah, blah. But
or
you're
swinging
testing.
Versus rounding or something.
Yeah, but you're just, it's something that we do naturally. It's the sort of conjecture. Now we're going to test it. Now we're going to criticize the test and then repeat. And then it goes on and on. It goes on and on. And anyway, so I think we just have to be careful. Play it like you sing it, right? It's pointing towards the truth of the matter, which is we want to produce a great mental image of the tune in our mind. And then our job when we play the pipes is to try and get that to live in the real physical world that other people can share in, by the way. So if I have an idea of a tune in my mind, I only have a couple of options if I wanted to share that with Jim. I can't just, not yet anyway, I can't just be like telepathically, yo, Jim, check out this cool mental model of this music I have in my brain.
Wait,
you can't
Elon
do that.
Musk gets a hold of us though, then you'll be able to.
Yeah, you can't do that. But if I produce that idea as best I can on a perfectly tuned bagpipe, all of a sudden, that's something that Jim can take and be like, whoa, that was awesome. And then he can potentially even replicate that himself in his own unique way. so on and so forth. It's fascinating. It's really cool.
I think I know what you mean. I just want to make sure it's clear. When you talk about having this mental image, and you clarified before, it's maybe a mental model. It's not necessarily visual, you said, right? Maybe it is if that's the way we're thinking of it, but some kind of a mental model of the tune, the idea, the creative idea.
Yeah, or just the idea itself. Like there's an idea in your mind. Mm-hmm. And it might be very primitively formed, right? And then the only way we're going to make it less primitive and more refined is by testing it against reality. Mm-hmm. And that's where humming comes in, or whistling comes in, or drumming on your lap comes in. Or, by the way, listening to other people do this same idea comes in a big way, right?
For sure, yeah.
Aha, Jack Lee, when he plays it, that differs from my mental model in the following ways. Aha, okay, so maybe you decide to incorporate some of that, right? So maybe there's immersion in there. It's all kind of related. Yeah, but then our job, what we need to do in order to get those ideas out there and make them replicatable across other people is we need to sing them, or we need to play them on our bagpipes, or I can maybe play my piano. Maybe that's, especially if I already play piano, that could be a great way work through some ideas and to think about them. Notice that each method that you use has its own unique qualities as well. Like on a piano, I could play some chords underneath, which really inform my mental model, even though on the bagpipes, we can't play chords. But if you're aware of what they are, it can really help shape and develop your mental idea of the tune. Yeah, absolutely. And then if you sing it, you can use dynamics, which on the bagpipes, we can't really control our dynamics. But when we sing, you can. So that's why pipers are going to sing a lot, is because if I'm going to sort of develop my mental idea of a 2-4 march, it's probably going to involve some emphasis on the left foot. And you know that because when I sing it and I apply that emphasis, it's really effective. So now I know when I play it on my bagpipes, I want to figure out a way to emphasize that because I know it'll increase the effectiveness of the tune. But it's all just fascinating. And by the way, now if we talk about recording, so recording something, let's say I make an MP3 recording of my playing of a tune, there's fascinating pros and cons to that, right? Like the upside is now it's not just the people in the room with me that can share in my attempted production of what's in my mind. Now we can record that, and now we can disseminate it widely across the universe for all time. But there's pros and cons to that, because no one performance is going, a performance is never, this is the beauty of it all, you're never going to successfully reproduce the image in your mind into the real world, right? You're never going to finish perfecting the idea in your mind, and then you're never going to be able to perfectly reproduce it into the real physical world. And so now you have something stored in perpetuity that's by definition not perfect, but it's going to...
It's like immediately out of date.
The moment you put it out in the physical world, it's already known to be imperfect, because it would be a perfect reproduction, it would be impossible.
Man, I love that you brought up that it's not just that you can never perfectly express what's in your mind, you're just like chasing that. And again, that's a joyful chase, right? You enjoy chasing that, but also what's in your mind changes too, right? Yeah. It continues changing too. So it's just like this double chase.
It just really random tangent. It's also why I'm not worried about artificial intelligence taking over the world. It's like, this is a universal, if we ever do create a computer that's actually intelligent, they're going to have the same problem in the sense that there is no perfectly formed idea. And even if there were, it would be impossible to perfectly enact that idea into physical space. I'm not that worried. I mean, I'm definitely worried that they're going to be way better bagpipers than me, and it's going to put me out of a job. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not worried that they're going to savagely try to kill us all in our sleep, because they're going to be conscious, thinking, compassionate people just like us, because I think it's all kind of related. Right? It's all kind of related to the mystery of how to create an idea and then manifest it in physical form with perfect fidelity. It's never going to happen. Yeah.
Now this is maybe like painfully utilitarian or mundane for me to ask you, Andrew, but I can't help wondering about this. and maybe this is just a me thing, but the tune that you started with, it's a common march, and I can't think of the name of it, and I feel like that this is a great example of why this is important. It was like, da 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 da. Which common march is that?
Does it matter? So you have a copy of the tune in your own mind. So do we need the name
of it? I do, yeah. I have that. I can't think of what the name is.
Yeah,
I
what is a name?
It's not Baron Rocks.
What name is just... But a name is just a symbol, right? So for example...
It is, absolutely, yeah.
If somebody says Jim Moyer to me, let's pretend you weren't here. Somebody says Jim Moyer to me, what will my mind instantly render up for me in mental form?
You probably won't be able to quite capture how handsome...
Exactly. No, you're being funny. Yeah. You're being funny, but you're correct.
Hey, everybody. Jim from the future here, just doing the edit, and I wanted to make sure we all caught that. Andrew Douglas, certified EUSPBA judge, just confirmed that I am handsome. I'm going to play it back for you one more time, and then I'll let you get back to the rest of the episode.
You probably won't be able to quite capture how handsome...
Exactly. No, you're being funny. Yeah. You're being funny, but you're correct.
You probably won't be able to quite capture how handsome.
Exactly. You're correct. It's going to render an image of you in my mind, which will not be, it's not a correct image.
Mm.
It's just my reproduction of Jim. And then I only know you in certain respects, right? And if someone says Jim Moyer to your wife, please, Lord, I hope for her sake, it's a much different image, right? Than the one I have, but that's like what it is. So anyway, that tune is Green Hills of Tyrol. But what does that, when someone says that to you, what happens? You start to render the actual image of that tune, of that song in your mind. The name is meaningless.
Mm.
Aside from a little bit of sentimentality perhaps or whatever. But if the tune is good, it'll stick in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not good, it will go the way of the dodo.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's beautiful and makes so much sense. Though there's the practicality of being able to produce that tune when my pipe major calls it out for a parade. That's one thing that's always been hard for me. And I can tell you for sure, for a lot of years, I got that tune mixed up with The Wearing of the Green. They'd call one up and I would start playing the wrong one. And the reason that now I can always remember what Wearing of the Green is because I listened to Judy Garland singing it. And so now I have this little, I don't know all the words, but I had this little snip of her singing the words.
Mm-hmm.
And I can go, that one's The Wearing of the Green.
Exactly. But then just tie that into some of the wild and crazy stuff we've been talking about today. Hmm. So before Judy Garland, your mental model of Wearing the Green was like woefully inadequate and not particularly evocative. And it made it hard. It made it hard. And you struggled to even bring that forward in your mind.
Yeah. I couldn't get it to swim out of the mists. It was like back there somewhere. Yeah.
Now, and you can't put words to why, because if you could, you would just do that. Mm. Right. You can't put words to why, but something about Judy Garland and what she was, what she communicated to you, somehow that stuck in your mind. We don't know how, but somehow it did. And you kept that. And then now your model is clear. Now for me, I've never heard Judy Garland play Wearing of the Green. So I have a totally different model, therefore, than you in my mind about
and
how
yet,
that tune's
if we were in the
go.
Same pipe band and our pipe major called it off, you and I could come in together on that tune.
That's right.
Each and using if we were, our own models.
And if we listened to each, this is getting weird, Jim, but if we listened to each other as we were playing and attempted to create the best possible unison together, our mental models would begin to converge.
Hey. Yeah, right? You're right.
And then if someone heard a recording or heard us play the Wearing of the Green together, so now it would have like little bits of Judy Garland, whatever my model comes from, but also our best attempts to create unison. And then these are how these ideas are passed on.
Yeah.
Which begs the question, right? Which begs the McCrimmon mania, right?
Mm, yeah.
The idea that P-Rock has been passed down across 8 billion generations starting in 3500 BC from McCrimmon to McCrimmon. Like that
idea. I think it was
idea,
8 billion and 12. Let's be precise.
I know. I'm being facetious and annoying on purpose here and triggering on purpose here. Mm-hmm. Now, that very well may be true. But what I think is even more fascinating is just thinking about the fact that these tunes have been passed down for so long.
Mm.
And that you wonder what sort of transformations and sort of hereditary and what sort of mutations along the way. There's no doubt that the Pibroch Society injected a ton of mutations on Pibroch playing, right? Now, a mutation, that sounds bad. I'm not necessarily saying it's bad, but there's mutations there, right? You're taking these ideas and you're purposely putting some constraints on them. For example, this is how we're going to play cadences, I think. And it's so suddenly there might have been a million different ideas of how a cadence should be played. But now you're sort of, I think it was in the best efforts of preserving the music. That sounds good to me. Maybe all Pibroch would be dead by now if it weren't for some of these self-imposed mutations. So they're not necessarily bad, but they're definitely mutations. And so you have all these people and they have this unique way of playing, right? Think of the equivalent of Judy Garland. Maybe somebody heard Patrick Og McCrimmon play the tune and that's informing how they, and then they put their own little spin on it and then now they're playing it. But then Pibroch is struggling, so we're trying to preserve it and we're doing these competitions or something. And then now the way you have to play to be successful in a competition is going to be one of the key things that's informing people how to play things. It's just fascinating. It's awesome. So whether or not the McCrimmon thing, the fact that it was passed down in this beautiful line, I doubt that's probably exactly how it went, but it is freaking awesome and fascinating and endlessly, it must be endlessly complex how these tunes have arrived to us now in the way that we're playing them, in the way that they've changed over time in order to survive, right?
I don't know what else in the world makes me wish I could do time travel more than any variation of this idea of being able to go back and see which of those, what we could call mutations, have been left behind, right? We know what's made it to us, but how many variations and permutations and stuff happened along the way? It would just be fascinating.
Yeah, and to me, it's super fascinating because ideas basically do what our genes do. They mingle, they reproduce, they combine, and then the successful ones are able to recombine later, and the unsuccessful ones aren't. And so it really does evolve. And somehow we got here from the idea that you should play it like you sing it. But that's the big...
Well, I think it can make sense. That's like a starting point. Like, it's very natural to sing.
Really what it's all pointing to is in our mind, and then we're constantly testing that idea against reality. That's what it's all about. So how many times should you play a tune before it's ready to perform? It's really what you're asking is, how many times should I test and develop my ideas versus reality before I want to attempt to transfer that to someone else? But it's awesome. Science does this in a purposeful, well-documented way. And that's why we call it science. But artists do it in a sort of, in a different way, more organic, perhaps pre-scientific. And then you wonder, it's maybe what I'm doing as a bagpipe teacher is taking this process of being an artist and making it slightly closer to scientific.
It's interesting. Thinking about some of the guilt I have about the ways that I've failed students, I feel like that can actually fit really well, where I feel like what I've done is I've shut down something of creativity in favor of rules. And there's some kind of balance to be had there, where it's like you say about Pibroch, it's like there's this preserving quality that also ends up being restrictive, and you don't want all of either. It's like this back and forth thing, and they're both valuable. It's how to work with both as a challenge.
Yes, exactly. And I think as a teacher, we somehow have to just help our student develop that creativity loop, right? Which is impossibly difficult to do. And by the way, rules aren't bad. Rules are kind of good, but they're not all good. And there's no such thing, in my experience, of a rule that's actually true, right?
Like 100% of the time in all cases, right?
For example, the grace note system is a rule, but obviously the rule is broken all the time. It's a good rule of thumb, right? G grace notes go on the beat. But it's obviously not always true. But it's true most of the time, but not always. And then the areas where maybe there'll be a better explanation that comes along at some point in the future. And maybe it's our creative students that will develop that rule a little bit longer. Or maybe they'll take the pieces of the rule that are correct and add in other things that make it a little bit more correct.
Make it more correct. That's a good way to put it, because it's never going to be perfect, huh?
Exactly.
Just kind of inch a little closer to correct.
I think the truth is out there. I'm not sure we're going to find it exactly. Oh, and by the way, why can't you find it exactly? it's because our senses are like inherently fallible, and we experience this by, you know, or we know that this is true because we play bagpipes and we have an idea in our mind. And the thing that we try to produce in the real world is woefully inadequate. That's something that does seem to be actually, that seems like a rule that's actually true.
Yeah, that seems consistent. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But therefore, it sort of proves that we're fallible and that there's some sort of truth out there, but we don't know what it is yet. Mm. And then is art and exploration, is art in general just us exploring that? Science certainly is. Then, like, the next question is, okay, so what's the difference between science and art? Are they more similar than we thought?
Hey everybody, Andrew Douglas here from the Piper's Dojo, and I just want to say thanks so much for listening to today's iteration of the podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard here today, it would be super helpful to us and to a lot of bagpipers out there trying to find us if you could give us a top-notch review on whatever platform you're using to listen to this podcast, particularly Apple, iTunes, and Spotify, and things like that. Your review would be really, really helpful. So if you have a moment today, definitely go over there and help us out. Other than that, until we meet again on the podcast or somewhere else, thanks again for listening.